This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Tortoise.
Hello, I'm Giles Whittell and welcome to the Tortoise Newsroom, where we're joined by an audience for another live episode of the News Meeting.
The governing SNP ended its power-sharing agreement with the Scottish Greens.
And it's time for the SNP to now navigate the rest of the parliamentary term as a minority government.
The Senate passing a sweeping $95 billion package, including aid for key US allies, and laying the groundwork for a ban on TikTok.
The Court of Appeal in New York has overturned Harvey Weinstein's 2020 conviction for sex crime charges.
See, the horses there galloping through the streets. They belong to the Household Cavalry Regiment, which works in Buckingham Palace. It's believed that noise from nearby construction workers spooked the animal.
So, what should lead the news, apart from the fact that Arsenal beat Chelsea 5-0 to go top of the table, which inexplicably was not in that montage? To help me work out, I'm joined by Tortoise's news editor Jess Winch and reporter Stephen Armstrong. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
And by the journalist and broadcaster David Aronovich. He is the host of Radio 4's Briefing Room and a Tortoise series called 8 Years Hard Labour, it felt like 8 Years Hard Labour to make.
I thought for a moment you were going to say I was a tortoise.
No. You don't even resemble one.
No.
But it was a labour of love, wasn't it?
It was a labour of love, yeah. It was terrific to do.
And it's still out there wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining us, David. Let's start with long stories short. This is where in a single sentence or just a few words you tell us which story should lead the news. Jess, you go first.
Iran's other war.
Iran's other war. Okay. Stephen?
We can't get no education.
I have a rule against the first-person plural. A Pink Floyd? No, I don't have a rule against Pink Floyd. I don't know anything about them. But they used to be headquartered at the end of the street where I lived. A funny-shaped house. No. The rule that I have is against the use of the first-person plural in Tortoise news coverage. But anyway, that's beside the point. We can't get no education. David?
The election going on right now in which 15% of the world's entire population is entitled to vote.
Right. We can guess. Jess, you go first. I love the fact that in my notes it says, is the US really going to ban TikTok?
Yes. This was a last minute switcheroo on my part.
So how many wars is Iran really fighting?
So I think... So what happened on April 13th, as we all know, Iran launched its first direct attack on Israel, sending 300 or so drones and missiles across. But something else happened that day, which hasn't been reported, which is that Tehran's police chief went on state television and announced a new campaign ordering police out onto the streets in Tehran and several other cities to arrest women accused of flouting Iran's strict dress code. This action against women who are not wearing headscarves correctly has been going on for some time. It all started in 2022 when a young woman called Mahsa Amini died after being arrested by the morality police for that reason. And that kicked off the worst protests in Iran that the country has seen since the 1979 revolution.
Can I just interrupt? Isn't it true in a sense that it's been going on since 79? I mean, or is that a very crude understanding of how the morality police works? There was the 22 arrest of Mahsa Amini was part of a big uptick or a big crackdown.
I thought you banned the word crackdown.
I did. I'm sorry.
That was...
That's another thing. This is not a seance on how to write news for daughters.
Though, yes, there have been periodic protests in Iran since the 79 revolution. But what was different, I think, about 2022 is how much it was led by and driven by women. Since then, thousands of people have been arrested, detained and tortured. 550 people have been killed. Young schoolgirls have been hospitalized in toxic gas attacks. 8 people have been executed. Many have been sentenced to long prison terms. And on Wednesday, so just this week, a very well-known rapper who was arrested around October 2022 has just been sentenced to death. But the protests themselves, while the reasons for them didn't go away, they did fade out, largely because of the way that the Iranian regime responded, which, as you can guess, was very violent. So... I think it's interesting that while the world and while the news media has been focused very much on the external threats facing Iran at the moment, namely the risk of a wider regional war, further conflict with Israel, I think there is another level to the story that has been underreported, and that is the internal pressure on the Iranian regime, which is the domestic unrest. And I think the way that they are now visibly, again, very violently going out and arresting women, one tweeted earlier this week that she was arrested on the metro. They violently dragged me into a room and tasered me. They handcuffed me and one of the officers sexually assaulted me. She's been now reportedly arrested and transferred to Evin prison, which is where Nazanin was held. So I think the fact that they are focusing again on women as a way probably of more broadly stopping the risk of any further internal dissent is something that we should be paying quite a lot of attention to, because I think it is a force, it's a pressure on the Iranian regime, at least sort of as much as the external risks of a further conflict with Israel.
As far as we can tell, is there a connection in terms of timing between the war on the women and the missile strike? Was the former conducted at the same time as the latter in order to hide it from international attention, or did the regime fear an upsurge of activism and protest coinciding with the missile strike?
Possibly both. I mean, it was very much timed together. The Tehran police chief went on state TV at the same time as they were launching the missiles. And one, so it was obviously a very good way, if you wanted to carry out a banned word crackdown at home, to make sure it was done at a time where everyone was looking at, you know, other issues. Right. But an activist did tell Reuters that this wasn't a coincidence either. It was precisely because they knew the risk of further external pressures and a war with Israel that they didn't want to also risk further domestic pressure at home, which is why they've very visibly gone after anyone that might cause some.
Because, Stephen, you were drawing attention last time you were on the show to the fact of pro-Israeli Iranian graffiti. I was never quite clear. It was in English. What that was in Iran, it wasn't.
It was in English and Farsi. So yeah. It was, and it was in Tehran. It was on. I mean, if you go onto Persian Twitter, which I know sounds archaic, he's now Persian X, but that doesn't sound as effective. There's a lot of stuff which is showing. For instance, recently today, the last few days, people burning down banners of Iranian revolutionary leaders from what they would call the Islamic Republic, not Iran. A lot of Iranians would call themselves Persians and say that the country is occupied by the Islamic regime and they don't identify with their government. And I think we have a tendency to ignore that level of resistance and separate identification. And in the case of someone like Tumaj Salahi, which is a S-A-L-E-H-I, should you want to join the protest movement, say his name, that the activists inside and outside Iran, there's one called Elissia Lebon, who's a very articulate British-Iranian lawyer, say that when attention is drawn to individuals who are about to be executed and people say their name on social media, they make protests, and then the regime pulls back. They don't like this to come to attention. So the idea that you would launch your crackdown just as you're also launching your missiles would distract the world's attention from what you're doing and then get away with what they need to. And certainly the Iranian activists are asking people to pay attention, asking people to quote names online, asking people to apply pressure. And they're also very angry with the pro-Palestinian protesters. So I think there is this street-level allegiance with Israel, which is very interesting.
David, how do you rank the story given what else is going on in the world?
It's an interesting story. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, we tend not to have space for too many foreign stories, and we tend to select them. At the moment, Gaza more or less drowns out all other foreign stories. Ukraine has come back a bit more into people's perception. But, for example, there's been a significant genocide going on in Sudan for the best part of the last, 6 months or so. There's been sporadic reporting from it, and no one has demonstrated about it or said anything about it. It's hardly gotten the attention at all. Part of the reason is it's really genuinely difficult to report from there. Likewise, it's pretty difficult to report from Iran. Now, what you tend to get from Iran, as we know, are videos taken on the street of incidents, which we can take to mean something, but we don't know quite what they mean. But the overall analysis of the situation in Iran is that whereas there were splits within the Iranian leadership, that there were hardliners, softliners, that there was always some kind of room, some kind of possibility of dealing with people and the possibility of some kind of reform movement in Iran, and that that now has more or less disappeared, and that what you now have is you have hardliners and then you have people who are a bit more hardline than the hardline, and that's all you've got. And you get to a point of repression where it doesn't really matter what the people think, because there aren't the forces. Usually, when you get to something like a kind of major revolution, etc., what you require is some section of the ruling elite to break off and say, we can't carry on like this, and we're going to throw in our lot with the people. There is no sign of such a break-off. So consequently, you can have a lot of street protests if that you want. That will be put down, people will be executed, it will happen for a few weeks, and then it will have to die down because people can't keep that kind of thing going. And the lesson from this is, and the Chinese understand this very well, repression works, providing you keep at it.
Jess, your news editor, how do you tell this story, given how hard it is to get news out of Iran? Are you going to be very reliant on social media, on those videos that David was talking about?
Inevitably, yeah. And on reports from, there are a few news organizations, Reuters being actually one of the few, that do have reporters on the ground in Iran. So you're reliant on them as well.
And the why now question, you're gonna lean heavily on April the 13th.
Well, it's more that
if I were nitpicking, I'd point out that we're close to the end of April.
Yeah, but if counter to that is that this is the first we've heard of this second front that opened up on that same day.
Right.
So the point I'm trying to make is that two things happened on that day. One has been very widely reported. One hasn't, and is should get a bit more attention.
And the condemnation to death of Tumaj Salahi. I mean, I think that's happened this week, and that's bubbled things up because the young protesters have taken to the internet about this particular person.
Is he the rapper?
He's the rapper.
He's anti-regime rapper.
And do we fear the worst? I mean, the way this pans out, is he also going to go to the same prison and we're never going to hear from him again? Or
he's been sentenced to death.
Right.
So, and again, the Iranian activists appealing for help say that the more you talk about him, the greater the chance of his survival.
Right. Okay. So you spelt his name. Thanks very much. We will talk about him. Thanks, Jess. David, let's go to India. The election there is going to take 6 weeks. Why do you want to talk about it now?
Well, oh, you mean, should I have talked about it just before it started, or should I wait until we know the results, which we actually pretty much already know?
It's a fair question.
Scale of them. It is a fair question. Well, the actual answer to that is that I did think of two other ideas, but you said you'd already done them.
Right.
And also, I do think this is undercovered. We tend here, journalistically, to be interested in two elections, which are the British election and the American election. But India is such a gigantic election. 969 million people entitled to vote. 969 million. That's, incidentally, 59 million have been added to the register since they last voted in 2019. So those are all young voters. Can you imagine the idea of trying to appeal to that number of to 59 million new first-time voters? That would be quite interesting. The reason may be why people have been less interested is because Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister, his party is seeking a third term and is very likely to get it. But although we knew what we were getting roughly in terms of his promise in the first term in 2014, which was this sort of combination of modernization. He kind of created a system of competition for investment between the various Indian states as a kind of driver of this, with a kind of minor key, this Hindu nationalism. Actually, things haven't worked out so well. Indian growth has slowed. There is a lot of unemployment amongst Indian youth, a lot of them the new first-time voters, and so on. And what's increasingly taken its place, as often happens with nationalist populism, is the appeal to nationalist populism, essentially. 80% of the population is Hindu. The worry is that Modi will become increasingly authoritarian. His cronies increasingly take over the media and so on. Debate becomes really solidified around a certain around his kind of position, and in addition, you get this increasing use of the grievance of the majority against the minorities, which, as we've seen, is a horribly potent force. Sometimes it's one of the most potent populist forces of all. You know, we, the majority, are the aggrieved people, is a really kind of dangerous force. So there's a significant level of worry. I can't say that that would make a headline at the front of a newspaper, because unless it were to be it, but as an analysis piece, right at the top and in a prominent place, I would argue for it. So when I come to vote, I probably won't vote for my own.
You're not allowed
my
to.
Sort of suggestion. But I do want to hear what the third one is before I totally commit myself to not voting for myself.
I'm a sucker for GWIS stats, and there are plenty of GWIS facts and figures related to this. But help us out on one particular aspect. Modi is clearly a skilled politician. Park his credo, his nationalism for one second. He's a skilled politician. He has in his corner, I think his name is Amit Shah, the sort of Svengali of Indian politics, who's a bruiser, also a very smart operator. But in the meantime, and it's something we've been looking at, Congress, the party of the Gandhis, is nowhere. Is that a significant factor in the extent to which we know what's going to happen?
Yeah, it is. I mean, as far as I understand it, it is. I mean, there was a story this week, in fact today, I think, about the existence of deepfake AI in the Indian election, and one or two of them were trying to get Bollywood stars to suggest they were endorsing Congress, whereas all the Bollywood stars are lining up behind Modi and the BJP because they know what side their bread is buttered on, and so on. You know, that's where the majority is. But the one I really liked was from a Congress candidate who is the son of a much-loved former minister who's been dead for a while, and what he did was reanimate his father by AI to endorse him in the election, saying, "Yeah, I'm speaking to you from beyond the grave, and I'm really proud of my son." And I thought, okay, well, this at least is not a fraud, is it? Unless you're a very, very silly voter.
There's a great deep fake, which is also the subject of a feature-length movie on Putin out in September. But you can look at the trailer now. I recommend it to you. He's resplendent in lounge suits, judo kit, and soiled nappies. So you thought deepfakes were bad, but they can do some good in the neighborhood as well. Jess, has David answered the why now question for the India election story?
I think he's given the answer. The only one you can is that when you've got an election that, rather than focusing on a single day, starts in April and you don't get results until the 4th of June, when do you do it? How do you do it? When do you start? And I think, as he said, the reason for doing it now is just because, if not now, when? Like, you've just got to start covering this election because of the scale involved, because of the numbers involved, because of the implications of what a third term for Modi would mean for India and for all of the rest of the world.
And is it very condescending, Steve, or anyone, to look at this through the lens or ask the question about the quality of their democracy? The Economist had a graph showing by their own sort of index, declining quality of Indian democracy over the past couple of decades. Is that a worry, or are we in no position to be talking about that kind of stuff?
Well, the BJP is a phenomenally well-organised political machine. It claims to have one party activist for every 30 voters. And it claims to have street-level organisation at, of that scale. Now, there is some doubt about whether they have the 180 million members they say they have. The, you know, the numbers are self-reported. But it is an enormous and an incredibly complicated machine. And it grows out of this paramilitary organization, the RSS, which is a project that began in 1925, which effectively skirted the War of Independence or the conflict over independence in with the intention of forming, post-independence, a nationalist Hindu India. They were anti-secular, they were anti-Gandhi. And indeed, one of their members was the person who assassinated Gandhi. Now, if Modi gets a two-thirds majority in this election, it is argued that his intention is to fulfill that destiny and to make India into a no longer a secular state, but into a Hindu state, which means, and I think this is the reason why it's important to cover this week, which means very bad things for the Muslim population. And two of the big speeches at the weekend and on Tuesday from Modi have been very dog whistle anti-Muslim speeches. And senior members of his party, governors of states and so forth, have been referencing that favourite comment of commentators here, that this part of India is going to be placed under Sharia law any minute now. So there is this huge anti-Muslim element to this year's BJP election campaign, which hasn't really been part of previous campaigns to the same degree. So, and it has really reared its head this week. So I think this is why it's worth looking at this week.
Blimey. I didn't realise that there was, you know, I was associated with a debate about religion and secular democracy with Turkey, but I didn't realise that's where we're headed. Do you think that's a serious risk?
Oh, I think a lot of commentators think it is a serious risk. I mean, after all, after the last election, they removed the autonomous status from Kashmir, which is the only Muslim majority state in India. And, you know, we had the Modi speaking at the opening of the Ayodhya temple recently, which was built on the site of the mosque that was actually destroyed by Hindu nationalists some years ago, which led to rioting and communal rioting. By and large, Indian governments have been very keen to discourage what they call communalism. And after all, if you remember the scenes from the partition of India and Pakistan in 1947, that's hardly surprising. I can attest to the fact that they were immensely worried about anything which would offend any religion by the fact that they... I was there in 2006, wanted in Hyderabad to go and see that silly Dan Brown film, The Da Vinci Code, and they banned it. And they banned it because apparently some of the Christians in Hyderabad said it was insulting to Christianity because it's all this stuff about the secret bloodline. I mean, I won't go into that, but
it's a terrific
anyway,
story.
That particular. So this marks a very big departure from that and the mobilisation. Now, in many ways, you could argue it's not really in Modi's interest to go too far down this road, because too far down this road could lead to significant insurgency and, you know, people cooperating more with Pakistan, who is India's great and eternal enemy, etc. But on the other hand, if it becomes convenient for the maintenance of the party and the government to do it, then that's got to be a worry.
There's something rather wonderful about trying to imagine you, David, looking for a screening of The Da Vinci Code in Hyderabad in 2006. Good for you.
I would have thought anybody looking at me would think that's exactly why I'm here.
All right, David, thanks for that. Let's take a break, and then we'll hear what Stephen thinks should lead the news.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, Stephen, let's hear about your story in more detail.
So my story is a piece of research from the Nuffield Foundation, which found its way into a single newspaper today, which predicted that in 2030, fewer than 40% of British school children will achieve a good grade in maths and English, because the quality performance of British kids post-lockdown is going to deteriorate year after year after year. Because by 2030, the kids who are 5, 6 years old during lockdown are going to be reaching GCSE age. And the lack of social, emotional parts of the education, and even reading, writing and maths at that age, was so damaged that it's going to be incredibly hard for them to catch up. And the Nuffield Foundation's estimate was that this would lead to a reduction in income mobility of 15%, which would lose about $31 billion in lifetime earnings from that generation. But I think it's a far wider problem. If you do the kind of solid investigative work I've been doing today, which is to Google decline education UK 2024, you'll find there's a lot of stuff out there. There's you know, we are having fewer and fewer Brits applying for university education. We have a teacher recruitment shortfall of 38%. We have a decline in spending on school buildings. And this is just this year. So we've reached the point now where it feels like we're going to really struggle in 2030 unless we do something now. This is kind of a climate change moment. We know that things are going very, very badly and they're getting worse. And yet there is no sense of crisis about this. Only one newspaper carried the story. Those additional elements I put together, no one's grabbing all these things together and campaigning. This is a crisis for the country. How are we going to run the country if we don't have, you know, an educated generation to move forward? And I hesitate to say this, but I think to a small degree that's because of people like us, who would be middle class, sometimes private educated, didn't experience the same level of drop off during lockdown and don't therefore recognise the damage that was done to vast parts of the population.
Let's just stay with COVID specifically for the moment. I want to be sure that I understand why they've chosen the 2030 cutoff, as it were. It's clear that that is the year in which those who were 5 will sit, at the time of COVID, will sit GCSE. So the argument is, and I presumably the evidence is, that the younger you were at the time of COVID, the more your education is impacted by COVID. Is that right?
Yes, because the process of going to school is about more than simply the academic element. It's about getting you into the idea of education. And after lockdown, a lot of countries around the world concentrated on helping kids develop those skills which they'd lost by not going to school at that time, and we didn't. What we focused on was improving academic performance, and that had a very specific effect. Now, this GCSE cohort we're about to have in 2024, they will not have any support based on their COVID experience. They're the first cohort to be, for the government to say, well, we're done now, we fixed the problem, it's all over. And so anyone who comes afterwards won't be considered a victim of the lockdown in terms of what happened to their education. So the further back you get, all the way to the 5-year-olds who had the biggest impact, the reading, the writing, the basic maths, the knowing what it is to study with other pupils at a critical developmental age, they receiving no support.
David, isn't it the case that in Germany, you don't really start school until you're about 7? And so all that's happened here is we've got a cohort which has had the German experience.
Well, actually, listening to what Steve said, there were two elements to it, in fact. One was the direct experience during the pandemic of children at an early school age. The other one, if I understood you correctly, is that actually the British education system, and I take it that it is British, it would affect Scotland and Wales as well, whether or not that has been adversely affected by a series of things since the pandemic, which actually mean that it's the problem is ongoing. Because otherwise, what you might very well say is, yeah, you've got a problem for 2 years, or maybe 4 years, or whatever it was, but it will pass. And so providing you, maybe you could try, and this was actually the program, which was, or supposed to be the program, the catch-up. You give tuition sufficient to get people to catch up to where they would have been had the pandemic not happened, no matter what stage of schooling that they were at. So I'm presuming that one of the things that Nuffield is saying is that that either didn't happen or has failed. And then the second problem, as I said, that you're talking about, is actually there's been a deterioration in the education system overall. Now, that I don't know about. And although there are, you know, things like school buildings, etc., there are kind of indicators about that, I'm not sure that has shown up in things like the PISA results, which are the OECD's ways of seeing how countries are doing against certain kind of markers so far. So I would be interested to know about that. But Nuffield are, you know, they're a good organisation, and they're not a they're not really a campaigning organisation, so I would be inclined to trust them.
So, Jess, Steve's pitch seems to be basically, well, the PEG is the Nuffield paper, but yeah, the story is more a multifaceted educational crisis which is being undercovered. Do you think?
Yeah, it's this idea you get a thread and pull it, and suddenly the whole education system falls apart from that one Nuffield report that was carried in the Guardian paper. But I think am I right in thinking that this is about pandemic specifically? They didn't look at, for example, then cost of living after that and the impact that's then having on the educational system as well.
This report didn't, but the fall in university applications from Brits, they tie in the COVID challenges, the cost of living crisis, and a general broadcasting of anti-university. There's no point in having university education messaging which is around. So they, in terms of the fact that for the last 3 years we've had fewer and fewer people applying for university, is a broader piece of analysis.
Yeah, because I just remember reading, I think the pandemic and the impact of that on long-term education is actually something that probably this is a good thing for the Nuffield Foundation to have focused on. And then you think of the impact of the cost of living crisis, where children are turning up and they are hungry and they can't concentrate, and then they haven't slept properly because their house is too cold, so they've had to go off for naps during the school, and kind of the impact that that is having on mobility, social mobility, income mobility, and long-term, just the long-term educational prospects for that generation of kids. And it is something you should be,
and there's also the problem of that
to
absenteeism.
Exactly. The people didn't come back after the pandemic.
Yeah, or actually that there is an attitude, an increased attitude, that given that you didn't have to be in school during the pandemic, it doesn't really matter if you miss a few days here or there after the pandemic, is how I've heard it described. So it's not... it's not mostly made up of people who are missing all their schooling. It's made up of lots of people missing bits of their schooling.
We covered a story earlier on this week about All Saints Catholic College in Notting Hill, where the headmaster asked for year 7 and 8 to be in school from 7 until 7. And it was talked about in the papers as being about reducing smartphone access, and the phones are switched off. It was cutting that down. But actually the headmaster was making the point, that's not really what it's about. It's about getting kids a hot meal at the end of the day. It's about making sure they have time to do their homework with the right support. And he said, it's all the things you get when you go to private school, but these kids are not getting. And I want to try to recreate that element of support which you get from a paid-for education. And he was doing it for £10 per week, that kind of concentration over 12 hours appears to be the kind of thing that we probably need.
So those are the stories. War on women in Iran, children struggling to catch up after their education was disrupted by COVID, and India's election. So I have to make a decision in a little bit about which one should lead the news. But before I do that, this is the fun part where you three get to choose which one you think should lead the news. And you can't choose your own. Jess, you go first.
I was going to go for GCSEs because I thought that India just India election in and of itself wasn't enough of a hook to actually run it this week. But actually, Steve mentioning Modi's speech and that kind of shift in tone, I think, does give it the hook and does give it then the opening to explain why it's so important this year. So I'll go with India.
Okay. David?
In other words, Steve sold my story to you.
Yeah, he tried it on.
Okay.
Good of you to acknowledge.
This is actually a slightly kind of tricky one. I would normally be reluctant to go off the basis of a single report by a single organisation. Both stories told me things I didn't know, which is always useful. So it is rather difficult. I think that given that there is an election coming up, the listeners, from what I hear about your demographic, are more likely to be interested in the education story than the readers. Because as I know from all my years doing current affairs programmes, older people are not that interested in education.
They've had it.
They've had it and so on. So it tends to be kind of younger people who are interested in education. So I think, given the election, I'd probably go for the education story. But not that I wasn't very interested in the Iranian story. He covered his bum quickly.
Stephen, which one are you choosing?
Well, I am equally torn. I love the time that I spent in Iran. I love the Iranian people I met. I got a certain heartstring pluck on me. But
I'm sensing a but.
Yeah, the stats, David's stats have won over you. How can you ignore a story about an eighth of the world's population making a decision and a critical twist in that debate? I think it's you know, it has to be India.
Okay, so Stephen takes a Benthamite approach. This is the approach I take. I'm going to be lazy about the Indian story. I completely buy the intrinsic importance, but I'm going to be lazy in the sense that we've got 6 weeks to get our heads around it, and we will cover all aspects, the decline of the Congress Party, the drift towards Hindu nationalism in due course. I say that, but I'm also aware that we say it and we very often don't do it. It's an incredibly undercovered part of the world in this part of the world. Nor is... Hold your breath.
It's always been known for its decisiveness.
But, oddly, I've made up my mind. I'm just trying to remember. Oh, yes. Nor, I'm just trying to remember what the other story that I'm not voting for is.
Imagine Steve. The Oscars done like this. And the two winners are not.
I think it's nicer to start with, you know, at the bottom of the class and move up to the winner. The education crisis in the UK is not going to lead the news. I am grateful for the insight that listeners tend to be more interested in readers, and we hope that we'll have some listeners to this episode, and I apologise if I've offended you. I buy completely that there is a sort of slow burn or slow boil educational crisis here, but today I am going to put the Iran story, Iran's second front, as it were, against its own women at the top of the news, because look at the footage. Women are being bundled into vans again and abused and tortured just for being women and not covering their heads. And I think whenever we have any concrete evidence of the clash between the people and the regime, we got to report it. We got to report it prominently. So that is how I'd run the stories. But this is your chance to raise your hand, Paul, and tell us what you think.
I think the most interesting story that's currently running is what on earth happened with the cavalry horses running around.
Yes, yes.
You're absolutely right. We should have mentioned that. You're absolutely right. So just go back to the beginning for a second. For new readers, just remind us what happened.
Okay, well, nobody's actually sure, which is part and parcel of this story. It broke on Twitter. People were filming the horses in different parts of London as they ran into buses and over cars. There was a exercise by the Household Cavalry in Belgravia. There was a builder's rubble tumbled and triggered the horses, who then dismounted their riders, and the horses just ran around the streets of London. Buses, one had quite a serious incident, I believe, in Brixton.
In Brixton? One of them
went quite away.
but in all kinds of different directions as well, because some of them ran east.
Strand, in Brixton, in Belgrade. I mean, they were all over the place.
Thank you, Paul. Any other stories that we should have covered? Yes, over there.
I think it was mentioned briefly at the top of the show, but the option for the US in terms of the TikTok ban, do you think it will be banned? What's next for it? Do you think someone's going to come in and buy the US version of the app and create its own? I think it's really important, especially in terms of the US election and how much impact social media, TikTok in particular, is having on that. So it's a big American story.
Yep. I came this close to pitching that today. For those reasons, because I think this story matters because 170 million Americans use it, because Biden has recently joined TikTok but signed the bill to ban it. Trump led the effort when he was president to try and ban it and got blocked in the courts. But he's now done a switcheroo and says, no, we shouldn't, because that'll give more traffic to Facebook. So you've got a difference, quite an important political difference there. Because I think if it had happened on its own, it would have led the news. But it was part of a package of Ukraine and Israel aid, which is why it was kind of the second story, like the bullet point underneath that. And it probably, I think it is a big deal. The reason that I didn't pitch it today is because we sort of knew that this was coming in the Senate this week, that it would probably pass. An earlier version passed the House, which is when it felt like more of a surprise. And because the app in and of itself isn't going anywhere anytime soon, it's widely expected that it will go immediately to a court challenge. TikTok might win, in which case, fine, that's fine. They can stay. And if they lose, then that's when it will get, I think, really interesting, because then the questions go to who would buy it? Will the Chinese government even allow it to be available for sale? And that, I think, is when you need to pay a lot more attention, because if it is banned, if it goes in the US, I think where the US leads on things like that around national security concerns in China, other countries tend to follow.
But also, I think Meta has actively started downweighting political content ahead of the election. So it's starting to work out what happens to social media in this election. And it seemed like TikTok was actually one of the few social media platforms that was not restricting or downweighting social media content. So which is kind of counterintuitive, really. You'd think that it would be the people like Meta who did very well out of the last election, but there appears to be a great reluctance in Silicon Valley to get involved.
Do you use TikTok, David?
No.
You don't even dance?
But I have daughters, and my youngest daughter is very good at that kind of thing and understands about it. And so if I wanted to know about it, and I don't particularly. I mean, I know I ought to, really, but, you know, sufficient until the day, you know, there are things you actually need to know for your job, etc., and the things actually which are better left to other people. So however, I do see the importance of the question about whether or not the United States can simply say to another country, for whatever reason, you know, that big thing you've got, we're having it. We're not going to, and unless you give it to us, then you can't kind of operate with us. Has quite interesting implications we're beginning to live in a more protectionist era anyway. So it has, to me, quite interesting implications. But one of the things I've been very interested in discovering is that one of the casualties of the downgrading of political content on Meta has been the right-wing sites. Have done very badly out of it because they're not driving traffic in the same way. By far and away, it was quite interesting, but before the 2020 election, the Republicans were complaining like hell that they were discriminated against by Facebook and other, and it transpired that 80% or something like that of the political traffic on Facebook was pro-Trump. I think that was roughly the kind of figure. So actually, they'd done very, very well, the Republicans, out of social media. And once you begin to kind of, the snipping of that that line looks initially to be relatively bad news for them.
Thank you for that. Remember, you can email us about the stories you think we've missed. Just send your thoughts to newsmeeting@tortoisemedia.com. Thank you all for coming to take part in the news meeting. Jess and Stephen, thank you. And David, especially, thank you for coming. That's it for this episode of the news meeting. We'll be back on Monday. Until then, have a lovely weekend.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.